These voices made headlines this week.
I'll be around a good while.
Here a block here, and then two blocks there, violence breaks out. By the time they get there, the people scatter.
As I understand it, there are going to be a number of the Air Force prisoners that are going to be on trial in North Vietnam.
The ABC Radio Network presents Voices in the Headlines, the sounds of the news this week gathered from around the world by the staff of ABC Radio News.
This is Fred Foy with Voices in the Headlines. Chicago, the Windy City, a giant city astride the American heartland. Chicago, a modern American city trying to come to grips with the problems of this age, among them, civil rights.
I'll be around a good while. I don't think we can deal with these problems in the next week or in the next month or in the next 3 or 4 months. So that while I haven't set a timetable or a particular date, we will be here several more months.
Dr. Martin Luther King was in Chicago to lead Negroes in a nonviolent campaign for equality in jobs, education, and opportunity. But the Queen City of the Midwest was in for a bad week, in which the voices of nonviolence were swallowed by the savagery of mobs in the streets. The streets of Chicago's West Side rang to the rattle of gunfire as Negroes began rioting Tuesday night when police had tried to shut off fire hydrants. But Tuesday night's troubles were only prelude for worse riots. On Wednesday, ABC's Don Farmer reported,
"Chicago's West Side is a patchwork of violence at this hour. I'm in the ABC mobile unit heading toward an intersection where trouble is brewing. Large crowds of angry Negroes are there. One of our ABC news cars was stoned as it passed through the area a short time ago. All over the West Side, we hear reports of sporadic outbreaks of violence. Rock throwing, a few Molotov cocktails, and hundreds of police are rushing to the scenes of trouble. It will indeed be a long night here. Don Farmer, ABC, in the mobile unit on Chicago's Southwest Side."
The rioting continued through the night Wednesday and broke out again on Thursday and Friday. Again, Don Farmer on the scene.
"Right now we're watching a group of policemen they have three Negroes arrested. Their hands are up against the wall and they're being searched. To get to them, police broke into a building. A bus came by and someone shot at it, and the bullet went just inches away from the head of one of the women passengers, a Negro. She almost had a stroke. She was so scared. Here a block here and then two blocks there, violence breaks out. By the time they get there, the people scatter. It's an impossible situation. Don Farmer, ABC, on Chicago's West Side."
A week of terror in Chicago as street warfare raged between police and the rioters. In all, two persons were killed, 57 wounded in the riots. Finally, elements of the Illinois National Guard were called out. Don Farmer watched them swing into action.
"Here in the riot zone, things are relatively quiet at this hour. National Guardsmen are patrolling the streets on foot and in jeeps and trucks. The men have automatic rifles at the ready, bayonets are fixed, but so far they've had no reason to use them. Sitting here in the ABC mobile unit, we hear occasional shots ring out. Police report crowds gathering here and there. Some looting is reported. And the night is not over. Chicago is still in trouble. Don Farmer, ABC, on Chicago's West Side."
Chicago Police Commissioner Orlando Wilson explained why he asked for National Guardsmen.
"I felt that the situation has grown beyond the capacity of civil authority to deal with it. When policemen are being shot at by snipers, this goes beyond the normal duty of the police, and under these circumstances, we need the assistance of the National Guard."
And Chicago Mayor Richard Daley had some thoughts on the riots.
"The unlawful events which have occurred were brought about by criminal gangs, roving neighborhoods, streets to imperil lives, disrupt community life, destroy property, and to challenge with guns and other weapons the safety and rights of families and their neighbors."
And as Mayor Daley and other city officials tried to keep the lid on in Chicago, others thought the city officials had to bear much of the blame for the troubles. Martin Luther King said,
"I want to stop riots, I want to see them end, but I must confess that the largest job of stopping riots will be in the hands of those who lead the city politically."
Daley?
"And they, yes, Mr. Daley. I think he can do much more to stop a riot than I can."
Dr. King met on Friday with Mayor Daley to talk about the immediate grievances of the Chicago Negro community, and King and Daley agreed to take some immediate steps to ease the problems, including a review of the relations between minority groups and police. Dr. King summed up.
We had a very good meeting, and I'm very happy that we were able to discuss all of these issues and emerge with something that we consider concrete enough to take back to those who, in frustration and bitterness and everything else, are engaged in misguided violence.
But Chicago was stunned by other violence in what has been called Chicago's crime of the century. Near midnight on Wednesday, 9 student nurses were in their apartments on Chicago's South Side. Only one escaped an orgy of death by hiding under a bed as a lone man killed the 8 other nurses one by one. Chicago police told ABC,
"The survivor, Corazon Anuriel, is under sedation. She was not attacked by the assailant, but was bound, and after she was bound and the other girls came in, she rolled under the bed and stayed there throughout the entire period and after until she felt it was safe to come out."
And when police went into the apartment house on Thursday morning, this is what they found.
Well, the first floor was in orderly fashion, but the bedrooms were pretty well in a pandemonium. It was all rustled up. Sheets were all over the floor, pillows, blankets. And the dressers were ruffled, but there was no evidence of anybody ransacking any dresser drawers.
Coroner Anthony Toman also gave this description of the finding of the nurses' bodies.
One body was found in the hallway opposite the bathroom door, and 2 girls were found in the east bedroom lying on the floor. And in the west bedroom, there were 3 girls. 2 were in bed, and 1 was on the floor.
A shocking crime in the middle of a shocking week in Chicago. A week that ended with hopes that the racial troubles could be cooled by emergency measures, and that ended with the Chicago police apparently breaking the murder case. On Saturday, the police said their number one suspect was an itinerant seaman named Richard Franklin Speck. Police Commissioner Wilson announced,
"I'm very pleased to be able to announce that the Chicago Police Department has identified the killer of the 8 nurses. The identification is positive, being based on fingerprints that were found at the crime scene."
A national alert went out for the arrest of Speck. And early Sunday morning, the man was found in a Chicago Skid Row hotel, unconscious and bleeding from an apparent suicide attempt. Hotel clerk William Vaughn told ABC,
"I called the emergency police squad. They came down. We went upstairs. We found him in bed, blood all over the room, all over him. We took him down, put him in a wagon, and took him to the hospital. Then, big surprise, next thing I know, here's all kind of policemen on the place because they'd recognize who he was out there."
Speck was not actually identified until he was taken to a Chicago hospital, where a doctor recognized Speck from police pictures and then clinched his identification when he examined Speck's unusual tattoos. The end of a week that Chicago would never forget. In Vietnam, the United States kept up its hammering of military targets in North Vietnam. The former U.S. Air Force commander in Vietnam evaluated those raids. Lieutenant General Joseph Moore spoke at a Pentagon briefing.
"The strikes have caused him a considerable amount of effort. The thousands of people he's having to use to rebuild his road system, his bypasses, his bridges, the resources it's using, I think it's going to be pretty soon he's going to have second thoughts and try to figure out some way of disengagement."
But the nation was becoming more concerned with American airmen than with American air raids. The airmen in question, in custody in North Vietnam, prisoners of war. One of them, Murphy Neal Jones, was shown in Hanoi, and the communists released a tape which they said was Airman Jones.
"On 29 June 1966, I was ordered to fly an F-105 from Tak Li Air Base, Thailand, to attack a target in Hanoi. While I was approaching the target, was hit by your heavy ground fire. I had only enough time to bail out, and when I landed on the ground, I was immediately captured by your armed local people and military men. I am very much sorry for my criminal act against the Vietnamese people.
The tape that was said to be an American airman was released at a time when Hanoi hinted that it would put the American flyers on trial as war criminals. There was an exchange of words on that possibility when Secretary of State Dean Rusk appeared before a Senate subcommittee headed by Senator Edward Kennedy.
As I understand it, there are going to be a number of the Air Force prisoners that are going on trial in North Vietnam. The dates have even been set.
That has been threatened, Mr. Chairman. We're not sure yet that the threat will be carried out, or if trials were held, that any sentences would in fact be carried out.
Dean Rusk and others were part of a crescendo of warnings to Hanoi, telling them of the dangers they were tempting if they put Americans on trial. Secretary Rusk said,
"We believe and must insist upon the validity of the Geneva agreements on prisoners of war, that we in the South Vietnamese are conducting ourselves in accordance with those conventions. The International Committee of the Red Cross is provided lists of prisoners. They visit the prisoner camps. They have not thus far been able to achieve any effective working relationship with North Vietnam to do the same for the prisoners held in North Vietnam, including our own men."
There was a warning to Hanoi from 18 congressional critics of the American Vietnam policy. Idaho's Senator Frank Church read part of the statement by the congressmen and senators.
"Before the remnants of reason are irrevocably abandoned, we call upon the Hanoi government to refrain from any act of vengeance against the American airmen. They are prisoners of war, fully entitled to the protection extended to men in uniform when captured in the performance of their duty."
A growing number of warnings to Hanoi about the possible consequences of putting the Americans on trial seemed to be having no effect on Hanoi. On Saturday night, Ho Chi Minh made a radio broadcast in which he said there would be no chance of peace in Vietnam as long as Americans were there. The militant tone of the speech seemed to indicate that Hanoi was listening to no one. And on the subject of Vietnam this week, the President of the United States.
"Because we are trying to demonstrate that guerrilla warfare just can never succeed. Once that lesson is learned, a shadow that hangs over all of Asia tonight will, I think, begin to recede." "Well, you say, when will that day come? I'm sorry, I cannot tell you. Only the men in Hanoi can give you that answer."
Mr. Johnson made a bid for international cooperation, including the Russians this week, inviting them to join in the exploration of the oceans in general, and in a unique voyage by a new American ship in particular. The president said,
"It is our intention to invite Great Britain and West Germany and France and the USSR and India and Malaysia and Australia and New Zealand and Chile and Peru to participate in the first round-the-world voyage of oceanography."
The president was in a philosophical mood this week as he swore in a new chairman of the National Endowment for Humanities. The president said,
"Ours was the only nation that ever based on an idea that all men are created equal, that every man is entitled to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness."
But there were some Americans who had doubts about the promise of America as they tried to register to vote in Grenada, Mississippi. ABC microphones recorded this encounter on the steps of the Grenada courthouse between civil officials and the Negroes.
"Who wants to go in the courthouse?
Well, you can go
in. That this is our constitutional right.
Well, you can go in there for work of time. You're not going to
We will not go in there for work of time. We will not go four at a time. We will have to go in all at once.
And the power of Negro voters appeared to play a part in elections in Virginia, where old guard candidates in the Democratic Party primary were upset by challengers. Two conservatives were beaten, Congressman Howard Smith and Senator A. Willis Robertson. But one old Virginia name survived the upsets in a close race. Senator Harry Byrd, Jr. was nominated by Democrats for the senatorial seat he's held since his father's retirement. Senator Byrd's campaign manager, W.C. Daniel, was interviewed by ABC's Irv Chapman.
Mr. Daniels, to what do you attribute Senator Byrd's victory?
I think it's an indication that the majority of the people in Virginia still hold to the philosophy of fiscal conservatism. There was a small vote today. Had this vote been larger, of course, the margin would have been increased by that degree.
A busy week under the Capitol Dome in Washington. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee concerned itself with problems of European security and heard from Undersecretary of State George Ball.
Our first common task has been to maintain a solid defense and an effective deterrent, and this is still essential. It would be foolish to assume, as some complacently suggest, that because NATO has prevented Europe from being overrun for more than a decade and a half, we no longer need an integrated common defense.
While Undersecretary Ball urged preparedness in Europe, the man who ran America's foreign aid program, David Bell, spoke at the National Press Club about a disagreement Bell has with Senator William Fulbright on the subject of foreign aid.
Senator Fulbright would like to see a more speedy increase in the volume of assistance which would flow through international aid agencies. I think he's rushing the jumps. My personal view is that we're moving about as fast as we can get other countries to move along with us, because it ceases to be an international agency if it's going to be financed only by the United States.
And in yet another Capitol Hill development, the Senate sidetracked a move to put Senate Foreign Relations Committee members on the panel that looks after the Central Intelligence Agency's business. That plan was put forward by Senator Eugene McCarthy, and Irv Chapman asked Senator McCarthy about his reasons for wanting foreign relations experts on the CIA watchdog panel.
You feel that CIA is definitely a branch of the foreign policy making establishment?
Well, it's part of it. I don't call it a branch. It's a force, certainly, in determining policy, and certainly it has some operational responsibilities in the field of foreign policy, which I think are properly the concern of our committee.
And while Washington went about its usual business this week, it was rocked by two exposés. The first in the form of an announcement from C.D. Deloach of the FBI.
FBI agents at Alexandria, Virginia, today arrested a retired United States Army Lieutenant Colonel on espionage conspiracy charges, according to Attorney General Katzenbach. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover identified the arrested person as William Henry Whalen, age 51, presently unemployed, who resides at 5903 Dewey Drive, Alexandria, Virginia.
Whalen was accused of conspiracy to give Russia American plans for atomic weapons, missiles, and other defense matters. The FBI added,
the FBI director said that Whalen's espionage efforts were particularly concerned with furnishing information relating to military intelligence matters. Mr. Hoover said that the alleged conspiracy provided for the payment of various sums of money to Whalen. Whalen will be arraigned as soon as possible.
The FBI charges were denied by Whalen, who was released on bond. The next day, Wednesday, the State Department had another announcement about spies and counter-spies. The State Department said a State Department employee, Frank Merkva, had been a double agent to trap some Czechoslovakian diplomats who wanted to hide listening devices in the State Department. The State Department's Robert McCloskey gave more details of the plot.
From time to time, Mr. Merkva supplied the Czech spies with unclassified papers. I repeat, unclassified papers, such as a State Department telephone book, press releases, and administrative reports, which had been cleared for transmittal. During the entire period of his contact with the Czech espionage agents, Mr. Mirkva acted with the full knowledge and guidance of the Federal Bureau of Investigation and appropriate officials of the Department of State.
The State Department ordered one of the Czechs out of the country and told the UN about the espionage activities of the second man. American space scientists and technicians at Cape Kennedy moved ahead with plans for another Gemini mission, Gemini 10, one of the most comprehensive American space ventures so far. Astronauts John Young and Michael Collins prepared to take Gemini 10 high above the Earth on Monday, July 18th, for two 55-minute spacewalks by astronaut Collins, three docking maneuvers, and rendezvous with two target satellites. As liftoff hour approached, the Gemini 10 mission kept an eye on the weather, as NASA's Zach Strickland reported.
Weather still looks favorable for Monday afternoon, according to the U.S. Weather Bureau's Manned Spaceflight Meteorology Group. The forecast in the Cape Kennedy launch area calls for partly cloudy skies, surface winds of 10 knots, and seas in the offshore area of 1 to 2 feet.
The ABC Radio News space team was on the scene waiting to bring ABC listeners comprehensive coverage of Gemini 10 from start to finish.
Love and marriage, go together like a horse and carriage. This, I tell you, brother, you can't have one without the other.
In a few weeks, Lucy Baines Johnson will marry a young man named Pat Nugent in Washington. But the White House wedding plans were overshadowed this week by a welter of walks down the aisle. Actress Brigitte Bardot married again. 67-year-old Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas got married again to 23-year-old Katherine Heffernan. And Justice Douglas told ABC about his romance.
Kathy's been working in the field
of sociology
and has been associated with a clinical group in Portland dealing with the problems of disturbed people. So she's been very close to a lot of the kind of problems that we have in the law, like the responsibility, criminal responsibility, responsibility for antisocial conduct and so on. Those problems that are very conspicuous in the news these days. And so this is her specialty, and I suppose it was that was the intellectual interest that first brought us together.
But the big romantic news of the week involved singer Frank Sinatra.
Love and marriage, it's an institute you can't disparage.
50-year-old Frank Sinatra became engaged to 21-year-old Mia Farrow, ending months of romantic gossip and rumors that Frank would marry Mia. He will, sometime before Christmas. So went This World This Week, and the voices in the headlines.
Voices in the Headlines, a presentation of ABC Radio News. Written and produced by H. Paul Jeffers. Directed by Bill Gately. Executive producer Tom O'Brien. Audio engineering by Gene Carlson, Joe Palmer, and John Matalane. Special effects Harry Nelson. Your narrator, Fred Foy. This is Charles Woods, inviting you to keep up with the news every hour of every day on this ABC Radio News station. And to catch up with the news each week on Voices in the Headlines.